The Grand Hall. 348 years, 6 months, and 19 days ago today, the Parisians awoke to the sound of all the bells in the triple circuit of the city, the university, and the town ringing a full peal. The 6th of January, 1482, is not, however, a day of which history has preserved the memory. There was nothing notable in the event which thus set the bells, and the bourgeois of Paris in a ferment from early morning. It was neither an assault by the Picards nor the Burgundians, nor a hunt led along in procession, nor a revolt of scholars in the town of Laws, nor an entry of our much dread lord, Monsieur the King, nor even a pretty hanging of male and female thieves by the courts of Paris. Neither was it the arrival, so frequent in the 15th century, of some plumed and bedizened embassy. It was barely 2 days since the last cavalcade of that nature, that of the Flemish ambassadors charged with concluding the marriage between the Dauphin and Marguerite of Flanders, had made its entry into Paris, to the great annoyance of M. le Cardinal de Bourbon, who, for the sake of pleasing the king, had been obliged to assume an amiable mien towards this whole rustic rabble of Flemish burgomasters, and to regale them at his Hotel de Bourbon, with a very pretty morality, allegorical satire, and farce, while a driving rain drenched the magnificent tapestries at his door. What put the whole population of Paris in commotion, as Jehan de Troyes expresses it, on the 6th of January, was the double solemnity, united from time immemorial, of the Epiphany and the Feast of Fools. On that day, there was to be a bonfire on the Place de Grève, a maypole at the Chapelle de Brake, and a mystery at the Palace de Justice. It had been cried, to the sound of the trumpet, the preceding evening at all the crossroads, by the provost's men, clad in handsome, short, sleeveless coats of violet camelot, with large white crosses upon their breasts. So the crowd of citizens, male and female, having closed their houses and shops, thronged from every direction, at early morn, towards some one of the three spots designated. Each had made his choice. One, the bonfire, another, the maypole, another, the mystery play. It must be stated, in honor of the good sense of the loungers of Paris, that the greater part of this crowd directed their steps towards the bonfire, which was quite in season, or towards the mystery play, which was to be presented in the grand hall of the Palace de Justice, the courts of law, which was well roofed and walled, and that the curious left the poor, scantily flowered maypole to shiver all alone beneath the sky of January, in the cemetery of the Chapel of Brake. The populace thronged the avenues of the law courts in particular, because they knew that the Flemish ambassadors, who had arrived 2 days previously, intended to be present at the representation of the mystery, and at the election of the Pope of the Fools, which was also to take place in the Grand Hall. It was no easy matter on that day to force one's way into that Grand Hall, although it was then reputed to be the largest covered enclosure in the world. It is true that Saville had not yet measured the Grand Hall of the Chateau of Montargis. The palace place, encumbered with people, offered to the curious gazers at the windows the aspect of a sea, into which 5 or 6 streets, like so many mouths of rivers, discharged every moment fresh floods of heads. The waves of this crowd, augmented incessantly, dashed against the angles of the houses which projected here and there, like so many promontories, into the irregular basin of the place. In the center of the lofty GOTHIC asterisk facade of the palace, the grand staircase, incessantly ascended and descended by a double current, which, after parting on the intermediate landing place, flowed in broad waves along its lateral slopes. The grand staircase, I say, trickled incessantly into the place, like a cascade into a lake. The cries, the laughter, the trampling of those thousands of feet, produced a great noise and a great clamor. From time to time, this noise and clamor redoubled. The current which drove the crowd towards the grand staircase flowed backwards, became troubled, formed whirlpools. This was produced by the buffet of an archer, or the horse of one of the provost's sergeants, which kicked to restore order, an admirable tradition which the provostship has bequeathed to the constabulary to the tilde mareacutchausse tilde, the tilde mareacutchausse tilde to our tilde gendarmeri tilde of Paris. Asterisk the word Gothic, in the sense in which it is generally employed, is wholly unsuitable, but wholly consecrated. Hence we accept it and we adopt it, like all the rest of the world, to characterize the architecture of the second half of the Middle Ages, where the ogive is the principle which succeeds the architecture of the first period, of which the semicircle is the father. Thousands of good, calm, bourgeois faces thronged the windows, the doors, the dormer windows, the roofs, gazing at the palace, gazing at the populace, and asking nothing more. For many Parisians content themselves with the spectacle of the spectators, and the wall behind which something is going on becomes at once, for us, a very curious thing indeed. If it could be granted to us, the men of 1830, to mingle in thought with those Parisians of the 15th century, and to enter with them, jostled, elbowed, pulled about, into that immense hall of the palace, which was so cramped on that 6th of January, 1482, the spectacle would not be devoid of either interest or charm, and we should have about us only things that were so old that they would seem new. With the reader's consent, we will endeavor to retrace in thought the impression which he would have experienced in company with us on crossing the threshold of that grand hall, in the midst of that tumultuous crowd in surcoats, short, sleeveless jackets, and doublets. And, first of all, there is a buzzing in the ears, a dazzlement in the eyes. Above our heads is a double ogive vault, paneled with wood carving, painted azure, and sown with golden fleurs de lis. Beneath our feet a pavement of black and white marble, alternating. A few paces distant, an enormous pillar, then another, seven pillars in all, down the length of the hall, sustaining the spring of the arches of the double vault, in the center of its width. Around four of the pillars, stalls of merchants, all sparkling with glass and tinsel. Around the last three, benches of oak, worn and polished by the trunk hose of the litigants, and the robes of the attorneys. Around the hall, along the lofty wall, between the doors, between the windows, between the pillars, the interminable row of all the kings of France, from Pharamond down. The lazy kings, with pendant arms and downcast eyes, the valiant and combative kings, with heads and arms raised boldly heavenward. Then in the long, pointed windows, glass of a thousand hues, at the wide entrances to the hall, rich doors, finely sculptured, and all, the vaults, pillars, walls, jambs, paneling, doors, statues, covered from top to bottom with a splendid blue and gold illumination, which, a trifle tarnished at the epoch when we behold it, had almost entirely disappeared beneath dust and spiders in the year of grace, 1549, when Du Bruel still admired it from tradition. Let the reader picture to himself now this immense, oblong hall, illuminated by the pallid light of a January day, invaded by a motley and noisy throng which drifts along the walls, and eddies round the seven pillars, and he will have a confused idea of the whole effect of the picture, whose curious details we shall make an effort to indicate with more precision. It is certain that if Ravaillac had not assassinated Henry IV, there would have been no documents in the trial of Ravaillac deposited in the clerk's office of the Palace de Justice, no accomplices interested in causing the said documents to disappear, hence, no incendiaries obliged, for lack of better means, to burn the clerk's office, in order to burn the documents, and to burn the Palace de Justice, in order to burn the clerk's office. Consequently, in short, no conflagration in 1618. The old palace would be standing still, with its ancient grand hall. I should be able to say to the reader, go and look at it, and we should thus both escape the necessity, I of making, and he of reading, a description of it, such as it is, which demonstrates a new truth, that great events have incalculable results. It is true that it may be quite possible, in the first place, that Ravaillac had no accomplices, and in the second, that if he had any, they were in no way connected with the fire of 1618. Two other very plausible explanations exist. First, the great flaming star, a foot broad, and a cubit high, which fell from heaven, as everyone knows, upon the law courts, after midnight on the 7th of March. Second, Theophile's quatrain, sure, 'twas but a sorry game when at Paris, Dame Justice, through having eaten too much spice, set the palace all aflame. Whatever may be thought of this triple explanation, political, physical, and poetical, of the burning of the law courts in 1618, the unfortunate fact of the fire is certain. Very little today remains, thanks to this catastrophe, thanks, above all, to the successive restorations which have completed what it spared. Very little remains of that first dwelling of the kings of France, of that elder palace of the Louvre, already so old in the time of Philip the Handsome, that they sought there for the traces of the magnificent buildings erected by King Robert and described by Holgaldus. Nearly everything has disappeared. What has become of the chamber of the Chancellery, where St. Louis consummated his marriage, the garden where he administered justice, clad in a coat of camelot, a surcoat of linsey woolsey, without sleeves, and a surmantle of black sandal, as he lay upon the carpet with Joinville? Where is the chamber of the Emperor Sigismund, and that of Charles IV? That of Jean the Landless? Where is the staircase, from which Charles V promulgated his edict of pardon, the slab where Marcel cut the throats of Robert de Clermont and the Marshal of Champagne, in the presence of the Dauphin, the wicket where the bulls of Pope Benedict were torn, and whence those who had brought them departed decked out, in derision, in copes and mitres, and making an apology through all Paris, and the Grand Hall, with its gilding, its azure, its statues, its pointed arches, its pillars, its immense vault, all fretted with carvings, and the gilded chamber, and the stone lion, which stood at the door, with lowered head and tail between his legs, like the lions on the throne of Solomon, in the humiliated attitude which befits force in the presence of justice, and the beautiful doors, and the stained glass, and the chased ironwork, which drove Biscornet to despair, and the delicate woodwork of Hansi? What has time, what have men done with these marvels? What have they given us in return for all this Gallic history, for all this Gothic art? The heavy flattened arches of M. de Brasse, that awkward architect of the St. Gervais portal. So much for art. And, as for history, we have the gossiping reminiscences of the great pillar, still ringing with the tattle of the patrou. It is not much. Let us return to the veritable grand hall of the veritable old palace. The two extremities of this gigantic parallelogram were occupied, the one by the famous marble table, so long, so broad, and so thick that, as the ancient land rolls, in a style that would have given Gargantua an appetite, say, such a slice of marble as was never beheld in the world, the other by the chapel where Louis XI had himself sculptured on his knees before the Virgin, and whither he caused to be brought, without heeding the two gaps thus made in the row of royal statues, the statues of Charlemagne, and of St. Louis, two saints whom he supposed to be great in favor in heaven, as kings of France. This chapel, quite new, having been built only 6 years, was entirely in that charming taste of delicate architecture, of marvelous sculpture, of fine and deep chasing, which marks with us the end of the Gothic era, and which is perpetuated to about the middle of the 16th century in the fairy-like fancies of the Renaissance. The little open-work rose window, pierced above the portal, was, in particular, a masterpiece of lightness and grace. One would have pronounced it a star of lace. In the middle of the hall, opposite the great door, a platform of gold brocade, placed against the wall, a special entrance to which had been effected through a window in the corridor of the gold chamber, had been erected for the Flemish emissaries, and the other great personages invited to the presentation of the mystery play. It was upon the marble table that the mystery was to be enacted, as usual. It had been arranged for the purpose, early in the morning, its rich slabs of marble, all scratched by the heels of law clerks, supported a cage of carpenter's work of considerable height, the upper surface of which, within view of the whole hall, was to serve as the theater, and whose interior, masked by tapestries, was to take the place of dressing rooms for the personages of the piece. A ladder, naively placed on the outside, was to serve as means of communication between the dressing room and the stage, and lend its rude rungs to entrances as well as to exits. There was no personage, however unexpected, no sudden change, no theatrical effect, which was not obliged to mount that ladder. Innocent and venerable infancy of art and contrivances. Four of the bailiff of the palace's sergeants, perfunctory guardians of all the pleasures of the people, on days of festival as well as on days of execution, stood at the four corners of the marble table. The piece was only to begin with the 12th stroke of the great palace clock sounding midday. It was very late, no doubt, for a theatrical representation, but they had been obliged to fix the hour, to suit the convenience of the ambassadors. Now, this whole multitude had been waiting since morning. A goodly number of curious, good people had been shivering since daybreak before the grand staircase of the palace. Some even affirmed that they had passed the night across the threshold of the great door, in order to make sure that they should be the first to pass in. The crowd grew more dense every moment, and, like water, which rises above its normal level, began to mount along the walls, to swell around the pillars, to spread out on the entablatures, on the cornices, on the window sills, on all the salient points of the architecture, on all the reliefs of the sculpture. Hence, discomfort, impatience, weariness, the liberty of a day of cynicism and folly, the quarrels which break forth for all sorts of causes, a pointed elbow, an iron-shod shoe, the fatigue of long waiting, had already, long before the hour appointed for the arrival of the ambassadors, imparted a harsh and bitter accent to the clamor of these people who were shut in, fitted into each other, pressed, trampled upon, stifled. Nothing was to be heard, but imprecations on the Flemish, the provost of the merchants, the cardinal de Bourbon, the bailiff of the courts, Madame Marguerite of Austria, the sergeants with their rods, the cold, the heat, the bad weather, the bishop of Paris, the pope of the fools, the pillars, the statues, that closed door, that open window, all to the vast amusement of a band of scholars and lackeys scattered through the mass, who mingled with all this discontent their teasing remarks, and their malicious suggestions, and pricked the general bad temper with a pin, so to speak. Among the rest there was a group of those merry imps, who, after smashing the glass in the window, had seated themselves heartily on the entablature, and from that point dispatched their gaze, and their railleries both within and without, upon the throng in the hall, and the throng upon the place. It was easy to see, from their parodied gestures, their ringing laughter, the bantering appeals which they exchanged with their comrades, from one end of the hall to the other, that these young clerks did not share the weariness and fatigue of the rest of the spectators, and that they understood very well the art of extracting, for their own private diversion from that which they had under their eyes, a spectacle which made them await the other with patience. Upon my soul, so it's you, Joannes Frollo de Molendino, cried one of them, to a sort of little, light-haired imp, with a well-favored and malign countenance, clinging to the acanthus leaves of a capital. You are well named John of the Mill, for your two arms and your two legs have the air of four wings fluttering on the breeze. How long have you been here? By the mercy of the devil, retorted Joannes Frollo, these 4 hours and more, and I hope that they will be reckoned to my credit in purgatory. I heard the 8 singers of the King of Sicily intone the first verse of 7 o'clock mass in the Saint Chapelle. Fine singers, replied the other, with voices even more pointed than their caps. Before founding a mass for Monsieur Saint John, the king should have inquired whether Monsieur Saint John likes Latin droned out in a provincial accent. He did it, for the sake of employing those accursed singers of the King of Sicily, cried an old woman sharply from among the crowd beneath the window. I just put it to you. 1,000 tilde livres PARISI tilde for a mass, and out of the tax on sea fish in the markets of Paris, to boot. Peace, Old crone, said a tall, grave person, stopping up his nose on the side towards the fishwife. A mass had to be founded. Would you wish the king to fall ill again? Bravely spoken, Sire Gilles Le Cornu, master furrier of king's robes, cried the little student, clinging to the capital. A shout of laughter from all the students greeted the unlucky name of the poor furrier of the king's robes. Le Cornu. Gilles Le Cornu, said some. Tilda Cornu the said H-I-R-S-U-T-U-S tilde, horned and hairy, another went on. He, of course, continued the small imp on the capital, what are they laughing at? An honorable man is Gilles Le Cornu, brother of Master Jehan Le Cornu, provost of the king's house, son of Master Mahiat Le Cornu, first porter of the Bois de Vincennes, all bourgeois of Paris, all married, from father to son. The gaiety redoubled. The big furrier, without uttering a word in reply, tried to escape all the eyes riveted upon him from all sides, but he perspired and panted in vain. Like a wedge entering the wood, his efforts served only to bury still more deeply in the shoulders of his neighbors, his large apoplectic face, purple with spite and rage. At length one of these, as fat, short, and venerable as himself, came to his rescue. Abomination, scholars addressing a bourgeois in that fashion in my day, would have been flogged with a faggot, which would have afterwards been used to burn them. The whole band burst into laughter. Holy, who is scolding so? Who is that screech owl of evil fortune? Hold, I know him, said one of them, 'tis Master Andrew Musnier. Because he is one of the four sworn booksellers of the university, said the other. Everything goes by fours in that shop, cried a third. The four nations, the four faculties, the four feasts, the four procurators, the four lectors, the four booksellers. Well, began Jean Frollo once more, we must play the devil with them. Quote asterisk asterisk tilde fair la diabola quatre tilde. Musnier, we'll burn your books. Musnier, we'll beat your lackeys. Musnier, we'll kiss your wife. That fine, big mademoiselle Outard, who is as fresh, and as gay as though she were a widow. Devil take you, growled Master Andrew Musnier. Master Andrew, pursued Jean Jehan, still clinging to his capital, hold your tongue, or I'll drop on your head. Master Andrew raised his eyes, seemed to measure in an instant the height of the pillar, the weight of the scamp, mentally multiplied that weight by the square of the velocity and remained silent. Jehan, master of the field of battle, pursued triumphantly. That's what I'll do, even if I am the brother of an archdeacon. Fine gentry are our people of the university, not to have caused our privileges, to be respected on such a day as this. However, there is a maypole and a bonfire in the town, a mystery, Pope of the Fools, and Flemish ambassadors in the city, and, at the university, nothing. Nevertheless, the place mobbed is sufficiently large, interposed one of the clerks established on the windowsill. Down with the rector, the electors, and the procurators, cried Joannes. We must have a bonfire this evening in the Champ Gaillard, went on the other, made of Master Andrew's books. And the desks of the scribes, added his neighbor. And the beadles' wands. And the spittoons of the deans. And the cupboards of the procurators. And the hutches of the electors. And the stools of the rector. Down with them, put in little Jehan, as counterpoint. Down with Master Andrew, the beadles and the scribes, the theologians, the doctors and the decretists, the procurators, the electors and the rector. The end of the world has come, muttered Master Andrew, stopping up his ears. By the way, there's the rector, see, he is passing through the place, cried one of those in the window. Each rivaled his neighbor in his haste, to turn towards the place. Is it really our venerable rector, Master Thibaut? Demanded Jehan Frollo du Moulin, who, as he was clinging to one of the inner pillars, could not see what was going on outside. Yes, yes, replied all the others, it is really he, Master Thibaut, the rector. It was, in fact, the rector and all the dignitaries of the university, who were marching in procession in front of the embassy, and at that moment traversing the place. The students crowded into the window, saluted them as they passed with sarcasms and ironical applause. The rector, who was walking at the head of his company, had to support the first broadside. It was severe. Good day, Monsieur le Recteur. Holy, good day there. How does he manage to be here, the old gambler? Has he abandoned his dice? How he trots along on his mule, her ears are not so long as his. Holy, good day, Monsieur le Recteur Thibaut. Tilde Tybalt A-L-E-A-T-O-R tilde. Old fool, old gambler. God preserve you. Did you throw double six often last night? Oh, what a decrepit face, livid, and haggard and drawn with the love of gambling and of dice. Where are you bound for in that fashion, Thibaut, tilde Tybalt ad dados tilde, with your back turned to the university, and trotting towards the town? He is on his way, no doubt, to seek a lodging in the Rue Thibaut question mark quote asterisk cried G. Hindu M. Maulin. Asterisk tilde Thibaut O.D.E.S. tilde, Thibaut of the dice. The entire band repeated this quip in a voice of thunder, clapping their hands furiously. You are going to seek a lodging in the Rue Thibaut, are you not, Monsieur le Recteur, gamester on the side of the devil? Then came the turns of the other dignitaries. Down with the beadles, down with the mace bearers. Tell me, Robin Powispain, who is that yonder? He is Gilbert de Sully, tilde Gilbertus de Soliaco tilde, the Chancellor of the College of Aden. Hold on, here's my shoe, you are better placed than I, fling it in his face. Tilde Saturnalicious Midimus Xnuces tilde. Down with the six theologians, with their white surplices. Are those the theologians? I thought they were the white geese given by St. Genevieve to the city, for the fief of Rooney. Down with the doctors. Down with the cardinal disputations, and quibblers. My cap to you, Chancellor of St. Genevieve. You have done me a wrong. 'Tis true, he gave my place in the nation of Normandy to little Ascanio Falzapata, who comes from the province of Borges, since he is an Italian. That is an injustice, said all the scholars. Down with the Chancellor of St. Genevieve. Ho he! Master Joachim de Ladehurs. Ho he! Louis de Hule. Ho he Lambert Hockman. May the devil stifle the procurator of the German nation. And the chaplains of the Saint Chapelle, with their great tilde amices, come tunisis grisis tilde. Tilde pseudo pelibus crisis forratis tilde. Holy. Masters of arts. All the beautiful black coats, all the fine red coats. They make a fine tale for the rector. One would say, that he was a doge of Venice on his way to his bridal with the sea. Say, Jehan, here are the canons of St. Genevieve. To the deuce with the whole set of canons. Ab Claude Short. Dr. Claude Short. Are you in search of Marie Le Gifford? She is in the Rue de Glatigny. She is making the bed of the king of the debauchees. She is paying her 4 deniers asterisk tilde quatuor denarios tilde. Asterisk an old French coin, equal to the 240th part of a pound. Tilde autonum bombum tilde. Would you like to have her pay you in the face? Comrades! Master Simon Sanguin, the Elector of Picardy, with his wife on the crupper. Tilde post equitem seclita triura tilde, behind the horseman sits black care. Courage, Master Simon! Good day, Mr. Elector! Good night, Madam Electress. How happy they are to see all that, sighed Joannes de Molendino, still perched in the foliage of his capital. Meanwhile, the sworn bookseller of the university, Master Andre Musnier, was inclining his ear to the furrier of the king's robes, Master Gilles Le Cornu. I tell you, sir, that the end of the world has come. No one has ever beheld such outbreaks among the students. It is the accursed inventions of this century that are ruining everything, artilleries, bombards, and, above all, printing, that other German pest. No more manuscripts, no more books, printing will kill bookselling. It is the end of the world that is drawing nigh. I see that plainly, from the progress of velvet stuffs, said the fur merchant. At this moment, midday sounded. Ha! Exclaimed the entire crowd, in one voice. The scholars held their peace. Then a great hurly-burly ensued. a vast movement of feet, hands, and heads, a general outbreak of coughs and handkerchiefs. Each one arranged himself, assumed his post, raised himself up, and grouped himself. Then came a great silence. All necks remained outstretched, all mouths remained open, all glances were directed towards the marble table. Nothing made its appearance there. The bailiff's four sergeants were still there, stiff, motionless, as painted statues. All eyes turned to the estrade reserved for the Flemish envoys. The door remained closed, the platform empty. This crowd had been waiting since daybreak for three things. Noonday, the embassy from Flanders, the mystery play. Noonday alone had arrived on time. On this occasion, it was too much. They waited 1, 2, 3, 5 minutes, a quarter of an hour. Nothing came. The dais remained empty, the theater dumb. In the meantime, wrath had succeeded to impatience. Irritated words circulated in a low tone. Still, it is true. The mystery, they murmured, in hollow voices. Heads began to ferment. A tempest, which was only rumbling in the distance as yet, was floating on the surface of this crowd. It was Jehan du Moulin who struck the first spark from it. The mystery, and to the devil with the Flemings, he exclaimed at the full force of his lungs, twining like a serpent around his pillar. The crowd clapped their hands. The mystery, it repeated, and may all the devils take Flanders. We must have the mystery instantly, resumed the student, or else, my advice is that we should hang the bailiff of the courts, by way of a morality and a comedy. Well said, cried the people, and let us begin the hanging with his sergeants. A grand acclamation followed. The four poor fellows began to turn pale, and to exchange glances. The crowd hurled itself towards them, and they already beheld the frail wooden railing, which separated them from it, giving way and bending before the pressure of the throng. It was a critical moment. To the sack, rose the cry on all sides. At that moment, the tapestry of the dressing room, which we have described above, was raised, and afforded passage to a personage, the mere sight of whom suddenly stopped the crowd, and changed its wrath into curiosity as by enchantment. Silence, silence. The personage, but little reassured, and trembling in every limb, advanced to the edge of the marble table with a vast amount of bows, which, in proportion as he drew nearer, more and more resembled genuflections. In the meanwhile, tranquility had gradually been restored. All that remained was that slight murmur which always rises above the silence of a crowd. Messieurs the bourgeois, said he, and mesdemoiselles the tilde bourgeoises tilde, we shall have the honor of declaiming and representing, before his eminence, monsieur the cardinal, a very beautiful morality which has for its title, the good judgment of Madame the Virgin Mary. I am to play Jupiter. His eminence is, at this moment, escorting the very honorable embassy of the Duke of Austria, which is detained, at present, listening to the harangue of Monsieur the Rector of the University, at the gate Baudets. As soon as His Illustrious Eminence, the Cardinal, arrives, we will begin. It is certain, that nothing less than the intervention of Jupiter was required to save the four unfortunate sergeants of the bailiff of the courts. If we had the happiness of having invented this very veracious tale, and of being, in consequence, responsible for it before Our Lady criticism, it is not against us, that the classic precept, tilde nectus interesit tilde, could be invoked. Moreover, the costume of Seigneur Jupiter was very handsome, and contributed not a little towards calming the crowd, by attracting all its attention. Jupiter was clad in a coat of mail, covered with black velvet, with gilt nails, and had it not been for the rouge, and the huge red beard, each of which covered one half of his face, had it not been for the roll of gilded cardboard, spangled, and all bristling with strips of tinsel, which he held in his hand, and in which the eyes of the initiated easily recognized thunderbolts, had not his feet been flesh-colored, and banded with ribbons in Greek fashion, he might have borne comparison, so far as the severity of his mien was concerned, with a Breton archer from the guard of Monsieur de Berry.